We finished up our ACT study last Wednesday. I appreciate you so much going along with me on that study. I hope that it was stuff that helped us all to learn the Word of God and to make application in our life. A wonderful book to study and to consider. This morning, we're going to go in a different direction. We're going to start a new study on the kings of Israel. This is one I've been wanting to do for a little bit, Old Testament history class. We'll of course be looking at the books of 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. We'll get into Kings and Chronicles as we go along, as well as we'll sprinkle in some of the prophets along the way. I think on Sunday morning, if my memory serves me right, Doug will begin, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday, a study on the minor prophets. So those should pair well together. But I wanted to go through this study, begin this tonight, looking at, from a historical perspective, the nation of Israel. And hopefully, as we go along, as we're hopefully learning history of God's people in the Old Testament, that we will be able to gather some important guidance and direction for our day today. So, in this study, we're going to do a few things today. Tonight is going to be more of an introduction to the series, looking at the foundation of the nation of Israel and the beginning of the nation as God led them into the promised land. So our first thing is we'll look at the establishment of the Israelite nation, how God established these people to be his own precious possession. We will also discuss how God made a... I left some words out of that sentence, so I'm sorry. I don't know if I got it right on there. No, I didn't. But God made a covenant with Abraham. I'll fix that in post. I wish we could go back and edit all this. But how God made a covenant with Abraham, and really that's the basis of both the nation of Israel and Christianity, by the way. We both rely on that pact God made with Abraham. And then finally, we'll see how God set judges over the nation of Israel and how the people still rejected God despite all that he had done for them, and how those kind of lay the foundation for what's going to happen later, and why they struggle so much with rebellion and sin and idolatry. We'll begin, as I mentioned, by going back and looking at the very foundations of the Israelite people. Of course, as I mentioned, in order to do that, you've got to talk about Abraham and God's covenant with Abraham. Now, as we mentioned somewhat in our VBS, it's important to kind of break down the book of Genesis. It's really, there are two major elements, there are three major elements in the book of Genesis, three major headings in my mind anyway. There's the first 11 chapters, which is a discussion of the early world, right, leading up to the time of Abraham. And of course that would include the creation events as well as the flood and of course the Tower of Babel. And then as you get into chapters 10 through about 22, you get in a discussion of Abraham and Abraham's wanderings. And I think that's kind of... Abraham is symbolic, or the children of Israel are symbolic of Abraham. I'm not sure how you want to pair those two up. But that middle section deals with the patriarch Abraham and why he's so important to the nation of Israel and to us as well. And then the latter half of the book, or the latter third, is dealing with Jacob and his sons, the forefathers of the nation of Israel. And so right in the middle of all that, and at the beginning of the story of Abraham, is Genesis chapter 12. Now, Genesis chapter 12 kind of, chapter 11 ends with a discussion of some genealogies. There are a lot of genealogies given to us in the book of Genesis. And following the Tower of Babel, after God had confused their language, it gives us Terah's descendants right there at the very end. And so we learn some things about that family. Well, of course, the pivotal character that comes out of that, the person, is Abram. Abram is the son of Terah. Who are his brothers?
Nabor.
Who?
Nabor.
Nabor. And? Haran, right? Nabor and Haran are the two brothers. Now, Lot is the son of whom?
One of his brothers.
Haran, right? So, Lot, we'll figure it in later. That's just how they're connected. And so Lot is his son. Who's his daughter? Sarah. And Sarah becomes the wife of Abraham. So Sarah and Abraham, or Abram at the time, were cousins. And Lot is her brother. You kind of get the family connection there. Then you go right into chapter 12, and it kind of begins real abruptly, or it's not abruptly, but it gets right into the story of Abraham, or Abram. It says in verse 1, "Now the Lord said to Abram." Now, I think there's something implicit in that statement, isn't there? What's implicit in that very first statement of verse 1? Now, the Lord said to Abram. Abram and the Lord have some communication. There's a relationship that's already been established. There's a lot not written there about their relationship with one another. And so God, it doesn't tell us when, but sometime in the midst of all of the events, comes to Abram and he says, "Go from your country and from your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So that's verses 1 through 3. So God is establishing a special covenant with Abram. Now, there's been some people throughout this, up to this point, that God's had some special relationships with. Who are some of those people? Well, right offhand, we know Adam and Eve had a very special relationship with God. God even formed a covenant with them. Right, in regard to the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And there was covenant made with conditions on it. Who else has had special relationships that the Bible's noted along the way?
Noah.
Noah, of course. You know, we spend a lot of time looking at him. Verse 8 of chapter 6 says, "And Noah found favor in the eyes of God." Who else?
Enoch.
Right? Enoch had a very special relationship. Chapter 4, speaks about Enoch, or 5. It's 5, I'm sorry. If I'm getting my time wrong. It's chapter 5, speaks about Enoch. What's special about Enoch? God just took him, right? He didn't have to face the grave. He just, one day wasn't here. God took him. And so you've had, throughout time, some people who had special relationships with God. Well, Abram has a very special relationship with God as well. You think about later on, you have Moses, you have David, you have other individuals who have come along who have special relationships with God that others don't seem to have. And it's always based around their faith in God. And so God says, "I want you to go from your country." Now, if my counting's right, there are three major challenges that Abraham faces. Here's the very first one. The very first test, if you will, of Abraham is right here in verse 1, which is what?
My
this camp, leave his comfort zone.
Without any knowledge of where he's going. There's never a time that I'm aware of where God ever says, at this point, I'm gonna send you over to Egypt, or I'm gonna send you, I'm gonna do a lot of traveling. But God just says go. And to leave what he's always known, to leave his family, and to go, to follow God's command. What's his second major challenge?
No kids.
What?
No children at this point.
No children. How old is he getting before he had his first child? Are we with Sarah?
With Sarah. 100 years old.
100 years old, right?
He's 75 at this point when they told him to leave.
He's how old?
75.
75. It's going to be 25 years before that son comes along. And there's a real test for him and Sarah in believing and having faith that God's going to accomplish it. Now, does he have a little trouble with it?
Yes, indeed.
Well, Sarah had trouble.
Sarah definitely has trouble with it, right? And so, that's his second. What's his third test?
Offering Isaac.
Offering Isaac as a sacrifice. And so, the way I see it, y'all maybe think of a different one, but there are three major challenges that Abraham's given. And the first one's here in chapter 12. And so God calls him. He says, he first proceeds to give Abram his condition. His condition is what? To go. What's God's promise attached to the condition?
Make you a great nation.
Okay, he gives him three, right? He says, I'm going to make you a great nation, which is the child promise. He's 75 already. He's going to be 25 years before that child comes along. But he says, I'm going to bless you to be a great nation. This is the second one. I'm going to give you a possession. Really, it's a possession to your descendants. And we'll talk about that as we get there. But a great land. So a great nation, a great land. And then I'm going to make your name great. So three things that God establishes that will be great. A great nation, you'll have, your descendants will have great land. Your descendants will be blessed so that I make your name great. And it is, right? You go all the way to us today, you go to Galatians chapter 3, verse 27. In Galatians 3, what's Paul's point in Galatians 3? We like to point out verse 27, which says what? For as many of you have been baptized into Christ, have clothed yourself into Christ. So there's neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free. He goes to that list. And then, but it's verse 29 that's really the heart of what he's trying to say. Now, it definitely teaches baptism is necessary, and we can teach that. But what Paul's point is what comes in verse 29, which is what?
If you're Christ, then you're Abraham's seed, yeah. And heirs to the promise.
And there's that connection to Genesis chapter 12. And so that'll be the ultimate fulfillment of that. And so God says, you'll do this, I'll give you this. You go to chapter 17, just a little bit more about this. Again, a discussion of Abraham and God. I believe it's here. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you go to Genesis 17, this is following the events of Hagar and Ishmael, right? And they've left now. In chapter 17, God reestablishes or reaffirms his commitment to covenant with Abraham. Right. And so when you go to chapter 17, you read verses 4 and following, it says, behold, my covenant is with you. Right? So he's reaffirming the fact it wasn't supposed to be through Ishmael. That was not supposed to happen. Okay? I told you long ago it was from Sarah. So I'm going to reestablish it with you. I'm going to re-educate you on this. He says, behold, my covenant is with you. And you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram. Now it's interesting, it's at this point, in order to reestablish this covenant, not only does he restate his promises, But he even changes Abram's name. What's the purpose of that?
He wants to be the father.
What does Abraham mean? The father of many nations, right? So he's giving some solidity to that promise. He says, I'm even going to call you that. You're the father of many nations. That's just how you're going to be known from now on. And so he says, for I have made you a father of multitude of nations, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations. Now notice this, and kings shall come from you. Now, as of yet, they haven't had any children. And yet God is saying, not only am I going to give you a son, that's not really the promise, by the way. The promise is not of a son. The promise is what? A multitude of descendants. A great nation. One child may be fantastic. But that's not a nation. You can't go around. Roger can't go around town and say, hey, look, I'm a nation of Roger, right? Right? Nobody's going to look at him like cross-eyed. What are you talking about? You know? But yet God hasn't even delivered a son yet. Yet God says, trust, and I will deliver. And I will not only make you a great nation, but what? Kings shall come from you. And we'll have more to say about that as we go. Verse 7, I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant. Now think about that everlasting covenant. Why can this not just be about Israel?
Because God is going to include Gentiles, all nations.
Okay. Why can't it be an everlasting covenant? You're right. You're kind of hinting at it there. Dig a little deeper. Because the nation of Israel, is it God's people any longer?
No.
Is the covenant of God and Abraham still going on?
Yes.
Not with the Jewish people themselves. I mean, it can.
Yeah. God's covenant is now with
all. With God's children.
The church, right? We'll go back to Galatians chapter 3. And so the covenant is established as an everlasting covenant to be to you, God, and your offspring after you. And so he goes through all of that. Then you go down to verse 9. And God said to Abram, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you and throughout their generations. And so he says to Abram, he's reminded, this isn't just about you. It wasn't enough that Abraham keep the covenant. He says, your descendants are going to have their responsibility of this as well. And that's going to be very significant. And then he goes on after that to talk about circumcision. So you have the institution of circumcision as a sign of the covenant between God and Abraham. And of course, we can dig real deep in that, but we just don't have time. I want to go back to chapter 15. I want to notice one thing here. In Genesis 15, verse 12, again, God speaking to Abram, and this is before, of course, the name change. He's not calling him Abram yet. He says, and as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful great darkness fell upon him. So he's having a nightmare, isn't he? He says, and then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted 400 years. I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And so God says to Abraham, basically what he's saying to him is, you're not going to see this fulfilled in your lifetime. It's going to be a while. And he gives the prophetic statement about the bondage they'll suffer under Egyptian rule. For 400 years, so they'll be in the bondage to the Egyptian people. And so God gives this prediction. But that will be something that happens in Abraham's life. What I find interesting is Abraham really never saw any of the three covenants. He didn't even see the land covenant. Now, it is fascinating that he traveled through the land, but what was the only possession that he had in the land of Israel? A burial plot. The Amorites sell this plot to him, and this is where he buries Sarah later on in chapter 22. And so he lived his entire life as a sojourner. I mean, there's some significance to that. He never got to the promised land in this life. There's definitely some application to us, isn't it? You go on to chapter 22, and I won't go through all these just for time's sake, but again, chapter 22 is when God calls Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. He's tested again. And of course, you know, I love verse 3. After getting this just kind of shocking command of God, what does verse 3 say?
He rose up early in the morning.
That just fascinates me. I might sit around for a while, sleep in. Maybe God will change his mind. If I just give him a little time, you know? He's not realizing what he's asking me to do, right? But he rose up early in the morning, displaying his true faith in God. Of course, the Hebrews writer clues us in chapter 11 that, you know, all along Abraham believed God so much that he said in his heart, his mind, that I know God's going to fulfill this. He believed that God would just resurrect Isaac. And so, such great faith. Go down to verse 15. You know, God again reassures him that he's going to bless him. He says, verse 17, I'll multiply your offspring as the stars of the heavens and the sands on the seashore. Again, reaffirming that. He says at the end of verse 18, because you obeyed my voice, you displayed faith. The faith was displayed through obedience. And then, as I mentioned before, in chapter 23, after Sarah's death, of course, he buys this burial plot. I said the Amorites, but it was the Hittites. I'm sorry. It was the Hittites that sold him his property to bury her in. Chapter 25, one thing is kind of quick, so if you have a question, just stop me. Just trying to set the groundwork here. In chapter 25, the text tells us that at 175 years old, I mean, he lived, you know, of course, life was extended quite a bit from our time period. He breathed his last, verse 8, and died in a good old age, an old man full of years. And was gathered to his people. Fascinating text right there. And of course, it mentions there that Isaac and Ishmael came together to bury their father. All right, so as we look at the book of Genesis, God establishes this covenant with Abraham, laying the groundwork for the nation of Israel to rise out of him. All right, now God already prophesied what? He told it in chapter 15. He told Abram in a dream what?
Children go into bondage for 400 years.
For 400 years, right. And of course, that's what the book of Exodus is all about. As we mentioned before, you go and read out the rest of Genesis, and then, of course, the playing out of Isaac and Jacob, and then Jacob's sons. And they're going from where they were settled to Egypt to live through the providence of God. And then it's there that they find themselves in bondage.
One thing that's interesting to me, if you think about, sometimes we read through that, the United States hasn't been a country for 400 years. That wasn't no short period of time these people were enslaved. That was a tremendous long period of time.
Very long. And, well, and so when we get to the book of Exodus, they're not in bondage, right? As we begin there. But verse 7 tells us, as we go on into Exodus 1, it says, Exodus 1 and verse 7, before that, verse 7, the people were fruitful and increased greatly. And so that great nation is beginning to occur in the book of Exodus. God had promised Abraham, he is beginning to deliver on that promise as you begin Exodus chapter 1. It says they grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Amongst the indication, and the rest of the chapter kind of gives you the impression that the Israelites were so numerous that they were more numerous than the Egyptians. Go to verse 8. This is why. If you go to verse 8, a new king arose in Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to the people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. And so, it seems to indicate to me, anyway, that the numbers are unbalanced in the Israelite favor. And now they're worried about them. And so then this oppression begins. And so they're so concerned, they begin to inflict pressure on them and persecution. Verse 11 to 14 tells us that they set taskmasters over them to afflict them. Now you can imagine, this probably was a little slow process, but you have the Israelites that are like, we've lived here forever. We've been in Egypt for a while, and now they're starting to treat us like outsiders, like rogues. You know, they're beginning to set taskmasters over us. And so it says they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. The more they were oppressed, notice this, verse 12, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. Of course, that's the providence of God at work there. God was blessing them even in the midst of persecution. Notice the end of verse 12, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. What do people do when they're afraid?
Lash out.
What's those three actions that occur? Flight.
Fight.
Is that not where you're going with it? Flight. There's a third one. There's one fight. There's another one. Is it faint? Is it flight, faint, or fight? Right? And so when people become fearful, often what do? They lash out, right? Instead of trying to be understanding, look at our country today. You know, and how divided we are. Why are we so divided? I would beggar to say that a lot of it comes out of fear. Fear of one another, fear of other ideas, fear of other things, at least in part. And so they are fearful. Verse 13, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and they made their lives bitter with hard service and mortar and brick, and all kinds of works in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. And so they really put it hard on hard labor. You know, I have no proof of this, but I'm convinced that the pyramids are the result of the Israelite people. It was the Egyptians forcing them into that hard labor, and they built this tremendous structure out of all that. Whether or not that's the case, I don't know. This is my guess. But they are oppressed, and of course, how do they react? Go down to verse 23. During those many days, the king of Egypt died. So you got that guy, he's gone. And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Interesting verse there. What does that mean? God remembered his covenant, and God forget. God was omniscient, right?
He
can
act upon it.
What does that mean?
No, I mean, I don't think it's remembered like you forgot. Not everything that you remember is something that you forgot about. It's just it was time, right? It came to his mind. It was forefront in his mind.
Go back to that passage in Genesis 15. When Abram has that dream, God says, and he prophesies to Abram, that for 400 years they'll be in slavery, under bondage. And then what does he say at the very end of that text? Do you remember?
The Amorites.
He said the Amorites, their wickedness had not reached the point where God was ready to come in and wipe them out. God does things in his own time frame because he understands all time. He knows when it's best to act, and he knows the right way to act. When he talks about God remembering, it's not like God forgot, right? It's that it was time for God to act, and God was ready to act in this moment.
That's what it says about Jesus, too. In due time, Christ was born. It wasn't like, this is a good time, right? It was already set by God, but...
Yeah, and God doesn't act in a good time. God acts in the right time.
The proper time.
And he's always done that. And so when it talks about he remembered, it wasn't like he forgot. God knows his covenant. That's why he continued to reestablish it or restate it. He knew people would forget. I love that at the end, God saw the people of Israel and God knew what he knew. I knew it was time.
It was time to come, yeah.
It was right. And so, we go on to chapter 3, verses 7 following. He says, then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. Now, who's he talking to here?
Moses.
Moses at the burning bush. He's called Moses, and now he's commissioning Moses for his mission. And so he says, I've surely seen the affliction of my people. Now notice that ownership terminology. How does he describe them?
My people.
Not just a people or the people, but my people. So he says here, I've seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I want to add a K there instead of a T for some reason. But taskmasters. I know their suffering and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians to bring them out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And so God hears their cry, and God acts. You know, sometimes people get the false impression that the God of the Old Testament is just some kind of judgmental, angry entity. And that's simply not the case. Now, God does get angry. God's judgment does come upon this man. God's also compassionate, and his great compassion is displayed throughout the Old Testament as well. And so God, out of his compassion and love, delivers his people out of their hands. We'll go through some of this kind of quickly, but begin there in Exodus chapter 12. I'm sorry if I go a little fast. If you have a question, just stop. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn of Egypt. And so as we read Exodus 12, 29 through 32, what is this? Death of the firstborn. This is God's 10th plague that he's brought against Pharaoh. Because Pharaoh refuses to submit, to humble himself before God. He continues to harden his heart against God, and so eventually leads to the death of the firstborn. Again, a very symbolic moment. There's a lot of symbolism in Christianity in this moment that we could spend a lot of time talking about. But God is bound and determined to deliver his people, and that's what he does. Of course, out of this comes the Passover feast, which was a feast or an annual activity that the Jewish people modeled it in remembering God's deliverance. And so, of course, he does that very thing. We go on into chapter 13 and verse 18. But God, and notice this, talking about the children of Israel. Who's leading the children of Israel? Many of us might say Moses, but notice verse 18. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea, and the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. God was leading. I love the way Paul describes this in the Corinthian letter, how he says that Christ being God, was there leading the children of Israel through their wilderness wanderings. Here again, Moses records in Exodus 13, 18, God is leading. And how did God do that? We know he had a very direct way of doing that, actually.
During the day and fire at night.
Yeah, so he had the pillar cloud by day, the fiery pillar by night. That's how he would lead. And what's fascinating is even in the establishment of the camp, where was the tabernacle to be placed? In the center of the camp. Over the tabernacle was what? It was the presence of God. They would see that by looking for the cloud or the pillar of fire. When the pillar of fire moved, or the cloud moved, what did that indicate to them? Time to get moving, right? The clouds moved. We, God, in a very literal way, led them out of Egypt and across the Red Sea. Go to the book of Joshua. Now, of course, Moses continues to lead them. We get into a whole discussion about the Exodus wanderings, but we won't do that in this class. But we know eventually, Joshua chapter 1 mentions the death of Moses. After the death of Moses, it was Joshua, the son of Nun, who was chosen because he was Moses' assistant and also had been very faithful to become the leader of God's people. Notice verse number 2 there, Joshua 1 and verse 2. God says to Joshua, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise and go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I'm giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses. So, in a very real way, we've seen how God has established his covenant with Abraham in making a great nation descend from him, the people of Israel. They're a great nation, a great number of people. Now, God, through Joshua, will lead them into the second part of the promise, which was the land promise. He says, I'm going to give you this great land, and it is a land flowing with milk and honey. And it's Joshua who actually does that, not Moses. So leadership in the human sense changes, but what about in the godly sense? No, God is still there and has always been there, even though now it's Joshua leading them. All right, and we'll continue this. next week. As he goes on, Joshua, God reestablishes that covenant again now with Joshua, and about how he needed not to depart from the law of God, but to adhere to the covenant promise. And then we will go on into later in the book of Joshua to see how God makes his covenant, reaffirms that covenant with the nation of Israel directly, in a very direct way. We'll pick up there next week. Thank you so much.